I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source. Let this be an introduction, yours and mine, to the late, great John Ashbery, in his own voice. Favorite son of American poetry these last 40 years, until his death at 90 last Sunday. He was famous in the wider world for what seemed to be his middle name, Obscure. But listen to these few lines, classic Ashbery, with a little teasing and play in them, but gentle, almost shy, drawing us, with language at a very plain level, to a bit of instruction we won't forget.
Paradoxes and Oxymorons. This poem is concerned with language on a very plain level. Look at it talking to you. You look out a window or pretend to fidget. You have it, but you don't have it. You miss it, it misses you. You miss each other. The poem is sad because it wants to be yours and cannot be. What's a plain level? It is that and other things, bringing a system of them into play. Play? Well, actually, yes, but I consider play to be a deeper outside thing, a dreamed role pattern, as in the division of grace, these long August days without proof, open-ended. And before you know it, it gets lost in the steam and chatter of typewriters. It has been played once more. I think you exist only to tease me into doing it on your level. And then you aren't there or have adopted a different attitude. And the poem has set me softly down beside you. The poem is you.
The poem is you, John Ashbery said, but our guard stays up. He was supremely well-read, in tune with all the arts, prolific, seemingly fearless. He had grown up gay in upstate New York, his father a fruit farmer, his mother the daughter of a physicist at the University of Rochester, a Victorian gent who knew Latin and read Dickens and Trollope, the sort of man John Ashbery studied and expected to be. He became the leading American poet after the patrician and very public Robert Lowell. Ashbery, by contrast, was a byword for difficulty, at least puzzlement, in contemporary poetry. So our first question is, must we do poetry push-ups or take a semester course to appreciate John Ashbery? Steph Burt says emphatically no, spoken with the authority of Harvard's chief critic and guide to contemporary poetry.
There is a kind of obscurity where the poem makes great demands on you that you can rise to or not, where the poem asks you to know something. And the poem might make you feel shut out if you don't get the references, if you don't know the things. And the poem tells you, look this up, or you're a bad citizen, or a bad reader, or a bad person. Ashbery, frankly, never works like that. Ashbery's poems do contain often a lot of concealed references. Some of them are to old French poems. Many of them are to Bob and Ray or Tom and Jerry or other like old Looney Tunes stuff or to 50s TV, to things that would be popular culture for someone of his generation. He's born in the 20s, or that were camp, that were part of the culture of mostly white high culture gay men in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And I often don't get those. But in Ashbery, you almost never need to get the joke or get the reference. There is not one right answer. There are multiple answers. There is not a consistent situation where you need to decode the poem and realize that actually it's about Spiro Agnew, or actually it's about this event in Scotland in 1750. The poem is supposed to slip away from you no matter where you start. Right. And that slipperiness and weirdness and sense that you never actually quite get it is one of the subjects and one of the sources of pathos in the poem.
Right.
So, of course, he's difficult, but he's difficult for me in the way that life is difficult, in the way that not being able to remember what you're supposed to do tomorrow or feeling like it's hard for you to keep in touch with all your friends is difficult. Now, if people want poems that seem straightforward, that seem transparent, poems that address what is comprehensible in life, rather than what is always sadly slipping away, maybe Ashbery's not going to be your favorite poet, and that's okay. I don't want people to shy away from Ashbery or think he's not for them because he's difficult at first. But Ashbery is a poet of slippages, of what we lose. When Ashbery is a poet of delight, the delights are acknowledged as temporary, which in some sense, of course, all our delights are. And that makes Ashbery much stronger and more apposite if what you're looking for is a kind of experience that is inward or shy or fragile or hard to share, even though I think it's always possible. Ashbery is a poet of I love you, but it's hard for me to say why. Ashbery is a poet of why won't you call me back? I don't know how I feel. Ashbery is a poet of I really miss the person I dated when I was 17, even though we're not the same people because, you know, now we're 70. Ashbery is a poet of I wonder what tomorrow is going to be like. There's no way of knowing, especially since I'm 80. Ashbery is not a poet of I'm so angry I want to break things. Ashbery is not a poet of call your congressperson now. Ashbery is not a poet of overwhelming and amazing sexual desire. Ashbery is not a poet of turning it up to 11 and screaming. That is not Ashbery. That kind of big public voice is not something that was within his register any more than the ability to do extraordinarily technically complicated quiet guitar playing was within the capacity of Bikini Kill or the Ramones, who are two of my favorite bands. Not every artist does everything well. And people who complain that with Ashbery, poetry became obscure are sometimes just people who want poetry that is public and loud and unambiguous. And it just so happened that one of the most capable and varied and rich and moving and thoughtful poets of the last half of the 20th century was a poet who was not public, loud, unambiguous, big. If that's what you want, go read Adrienne Rich, who is also great. We have poets for that.
Stepford, that's so helpful, but get us further toward a place where we can enjoy him.
Yeah.
As you do. He was very disarming, and you disarm him further by saying, you don't have to get every line.
You don't.
But there's also an attitude about life, and you're suggesting it, that the delights are momentary in a sense. We don't know quite what it's about at the end, so relax. Get us in that space, that mood, that insight that lets us hear him the way you do.
So I'm going to read you one of my favorite explicitly elegiac Ashbery poems. This is a poem, the romantic traditional elegiac lyric Ashbery. If that's your Ashbery, this is one of the great ways in. If your Ashbery is the avant-garde weird 12-tone what Ashbery, this is not going to be your favorite Ashbery poem. This is one of my favorite Ashbery poems. I think it sounds good for the first time, and it is slippery if you try to visualize the same thing all the way through the poem, and it's got weird, complicated syntax. But if you concentrate not on where the pronouns point or consistent visualization, but on what the mood is and on what you're being asked to visualize from moment to moment, I think it makes sense and it's pretty consistent. And if you want to visualize a thing, you might want to visualize winter on Fire Island, a great seasonal place for a gay community, but one that is especially vulnerable as a seashore place full of pine trees in the winter. If you want to envision something all the way through the poem, envision Fire Island. But that doesn't mean that's the real answer or the right answer or what the poem is really about, especially since the poem opens with a title that places it in an urban environment like New York or Paris, where Ashbery loved to live. The poem is the first poem in his great mid-70s book, Houseboat Days. It is called Street Musicians. Street Musicians. One died, and the soul was wrenched out of the other in life, who, walking the streets, wrapped in an identity like a coat, sees on and on the same corners, volumetrics, shadows under trees, farther than anyone was ever called, through increasingly suburban airs and ways, with autumn falling over everything. The plush leaves, the chattels and barrels of an obscure family being evicted into the way it was and is. The other beached glimpses of what the other was up to. Revelations at last, so they grew to hate and forget each other. So I cradle this average violin that knows only forgotten show tunes, but argues the possibility of free declamation anchored to a dull refrain. The year turning over on itself in November, with the spaces among the days more literal, the meat more visible on the bone. Our question of a place of origin hangs like smoke, how we picnicked in pine forests, in coves, with the water always seeping up, and left our trash, sperm, and excrement everywhere, smeared on the landscape to make of us what we could. That is Ashbery in his great romantic elegiac phrase, and every time I read it, I find something new. The many things that the word airs can mean earlier in that poem, the way, and this is something that certain kinds of professional literary scholars like to quote, the possibility of free declamation anchored to a dull refrain, as if all of poetry, or indeed all of life, were like working on or performing again and again a pop song, where you got to say whatever you wanted in the verse, and you could improvise. But the chorus is always the same. The chorus is something like, I love you, don't leave me. And in some sense, that is perhaps what all poems say. But the challenge, if you take a fundamentally lyric view of poetry, which some of Ashbery does and some does not, is how to say that in a way that like makes life better and more various and more fun. And Ashbery was one of the best at doing that that the American language has ever had.
Steph Burt's last book, under the byline Stephen Burt, made a title of Ashbery's words, The Poem Is You, 60 Contemporary American Poems and How to Read Them. Coming up, Eileen Miles and Adam Fitzgerald on the mantle of John Ashbery. This is Open Source. Just over 40 years ago, the master critic Harold Bloom set Ashbery in the great American sequence that includes Walt Whitman, Emily Dickinson, Wallace Stevens, and Hart Crane. One way to get his poetry, Ashbery himself said, was to hear it as music. We've also got to hear something of the love kindled by the man and his work. The poets Eileen Miles and Adam Fitzgerald, each in their own ways, grew out of the Ashbery work and extended. I'd ask you both, Eileen and Adam, what is it we owe this man? Start with yourselves. Adam, take the lead. Welcome.
Well, can I say everything? No, really. I mean, I was just looking back at my emails and realizing that before I met John in I think June 11th, 2006, I had kind of psychotically stalked him online and found out where he taught at Bard and the name of his partner and where they had a house in Hudson. And I furiously composed this email, which I spoke to my therapist about it today, just saying kind of how embarrassed I was at how how much I just really wanted to reach out to this poet who I had finally discovered and read and had read 20 books of and realized that he was just the kind of answer of everything I had been looking for in a living poet. And I know some people, you know, grew up wanting to be kind of, I don't know, Michael Jackson or Mel Gibson or Cyndi Lauper maybe. But after I discovered John Ashbery's poetry, I just wanted to be him and be inside his poems and think every thought he had ever thought.
Adam, I don't forget that 5 years ago you inscribed his original book, The Self-Portrait in a Convex Mirror, to me and said, Chris, if you work at it, you can get it. And I'm sort of well begun. Eileen, speak for yourself.
I think that In the 80s, I was the director of the Poetry Project, and I had the opportunity to introduce John and Ann Lauterbach to a really, really, really packed room. And one of my pleasures that night was to say what it felt like to live in Ashburyan New York, because that was totally the feeling. I mean, I came to New York in 74, and John, you know, got all the awards in 76, but there was already a buzz the second I got to town, to St. Mark's Poetry Project and the kind of downtown art scene, that there was this person who was the king, you know, and that was John Ashbery. I mean, there was Allen Ginsberg, who was a different kind of guy. I've got to say, though, listening to Stephen Burt, I was slightly amused, because it seemed like he was doing a John is this, John is not this, John is, and somebody had to get thrown out of the under the bus as what John wasn't, and it was Adrian Rich. And I thought, God, he should have had the nerve to throw a man under the bus instead of a woman. It seemed a little easy, because everybody's dead. Why not throw a dead man under the bus?
Stephen, I gotta take note. Is Steph now? But I've been wondering, does he make John Ashbery too easy, or almost too easy? And I'm also wondering, is there a certain false modesty in Ashbery himself when he sort of discounts his poetry as mood music, if you want to hear it that way?
I mean, I just think that we ought to take the guy at his word. I think he's talking about his work, and we all talk about our work. We talk about our families. We talk about our relationships in a lot of different ways. We defer. We're humble. We're arrogant. We're pompous. We're historical. We're philosophical. He's basically talking about what he's doing. I mean, the thing that's funny about having a conversation about John in the wake of his living and his creating is that there's just this tendency to sort of, you know, make everybody not worry about the difficulty of the work. And the presumption is that the work is difficult. And maybe the presumption is that art is difficult, or that artists are strange people. And I just wish we could just start, I mean, like right away, take the guy at his word. He said it was like music. I mean, listening to this show begin, we heard some jazz, and then we heard some classical music.
Some Rachmaninoff, his favorite.
And not for a second did we say, what does that mean? You know, this is
tell
a
us.
Burden on poetry, and I just think, let's just lift it. Let's act as if we all love this person's work, which I'm sort of assuming we do.
But you know what? You remind me. We have a genius chef in our family, and every time we rave, and we do, she said, it's just food. And part of what she's saying is, you know, yes, it is great, but if you had to live without it, you could. Life would go on.
And as an artist, that's the art of reception. You guys have raved. She knows she was a success. And so she just humbly, that's what you do. You just say, it's just, I'm just fooling around, you know? I mean, I think that's what was so great about John to the end, is that he always had this grandeur and this sense of humor about it at the same time. He was a touchable, great poet.
Is that what you do, Adam? Just slough it off when people rave about your work?
Yeah, as soon as they start raving, I'll slough it off. I wanted to ask Eileen a question, though, because she just mentioned about coming to the city in the 70s, and there was already this kind of buzz around John's work. So, you know, and I'm thinking, of course, of Eileen's poem for On the Death of Robert Lowell, which kind of, here we are in this very different moment, losing this great poet this week, and how different that feels. And I just wonder, you know, you said, Eileen, that like John had just kind of won all these awards. How is it possible that that people just continued from everywhere they came to just love John's work, whether they were people at the project or people in San Francisco, or, you know, it just seems to me that John could kind of create a loyalty and love and goodwill in the way that someone like Robert Lowell certainly couldn't, or maybe even sometimes Ginsberg didn't.
Well, I think it seems like when Lowell died, there was this awe, and there was this, like, how great he looked when he walked through Harvard Yard, and he was this patrician. And I think with John, I think everybody who ever discovered his work had an awakening. I mean, I discovered the work. I mean, I knew who he was and that I was to like the work and so on. But I was in a workshop with a poet, Paul Violi, and he got each one of us to pick a poet and teach them in the workshop. And so I thought, okay, this is what I'll do with John Ashbery. And I, you know, and there was an article in the New York Times Magazine that week, so it was very easy to do. And I remember in the article, John said something about how he was listening to John Cage's music, and he thought, why can't I do that? and just this realization that contemporary composers were making these kind of random, kind of sonorous, beautiful, hesitant, long, you know, notes and moves. And he realized, and thus, an abstract painting, and why can't I do that? Hmm. And suddenly, I was just like, I saw the light. I thought, oh, my God, he's giving us total freedom in language, that we can make these gestures, we can make funny ones, we can do Americana, we can be folksy, we can be abstract, we can, as he once said, we can talk about the things in the room as if you were in the room with me.
Stand by, Eileen. You're reminding me that the name John Ashbery is going to stand not just for poems, but for a whole era and an aesthetic sensibility that touches all the arts. He had really intended to be a painter, he said, until he discovered that poetry was easier. After college, his first real job was writing reviews of the Paris art scene in the 1950s. He knew everything about music, old and new, serious and pop. And he became a connoisseur of art film and even wrote some. The avant-garde filmmaker Guy Maddin, now teaching at Harvard, told us this week about Ashbery leaping into a project with him to compose a new monologue for an old title from the 1950s. It was How to Take a Bath.
Hello, I'm Marv. Today we're going to discuss baths. More specifically, how to take one. Baths have been around for a long time. The ancient Romans built fancy ones, like Caracalla. In the Middle Ages, they were called stews, because you had to be stewed in order to take one.
From line to line, and even from phrase to phrase within each line, he takes those Ashberian twists and turns, and they're delightful, and you're not even sure why sometimes. And he stays on subject, kind of, from beginning to end, with a kind of controlled delirium. God knows really what was going on inside John's head when he was writing these things.
Start drawing your bath until it gets to the temperature you want. Meanwhile, remove clothing. Carefully insert your big toe in the waters. This will tell you if it's too hot or too cold. Hopefully, it'll be just right. Once in the tub, start soaping. Start with the armpits and work down to the genital area. Work carefully in ever widening circles.
And we all in the audience smile and say, and I thought I knew what a bath was all about.
Yeah, and now what? I don't know. But isn't that what he really leaves you with anyway?
Elsewhere, Ashbery said that his writing was not made for analysis. It is analogous, he said, to an immersive experience like bathing. So Ashbery was drawn to film and filmmakers to him. Jim Jarmusch, for example, a hero of the independents since the 1980s for movies like Stranger Than Paradise and Coffee and Cigarettes, and last year for Patterson, about a working-class poet in the New Jersey hometown of the medical doctor and poet William Carlos Williams. Jim Jarmusch celebrated his Ashbery connection with us this week.
The New York School poets are really my godfathers in terms of inspirations. The Big Four: John Ashbery, Frank O'Hara, Kenneth Koch, with whom I studied at Columbia, and James Schuyler. You know, they were close with the painters and musicians in New York in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and onward. They used a lot of humor and experimentation in their work, so that's a huge inspiration to me. And also all of the New York School poets would agree that one of their mottos, whether they know it or not, was the aphorism of Oscar Wilde, who said, "Life is far too important to be taken seriously." And that kind of sums up the New York School attitude. Hmm. So they are my great inspirations. And I had the great honor a few months ago to do a reading with John Ashbery at Princeton. And John Ashbery appeared on a screen, Skype. But, oh, man, I was so honored to just be in a room, even though he wasn't physically there. It was just fantastic. At one point during the reading of one of his poems, he interrupted himself after a line and looked at the camera and said, "That last line seems somehow Jarmuschian." And then he continued. I was incredibly honored by that one.
Define Jarmuschian. What did he mean?
There was something funny and sort of musical about it. I'm not quite sure what he meant.
It suggests to me the question about his sensibility, his aesthetic, his humor. He would say the words in the poem aren't that important. What's important is experience. Stretch out on Jarmuschian, Ashberian. What's he talking about?
Well, I know that for New York School, or for what is Ashberian, I guess, is that the content of his poems cannot really be logically deciphered. They can be understood in the way that we can understand music, but we can't describe it with words. You know, he didn't like things being literal. His poems are beautiful to read aloud or to look at on the page. They are often imperfect intentionally in their rhythms. He would never be able to explain what they meant. I think he'd find that kind of horrifying to be asked. Also, you know, this use of humor and experimentation. In all the New York School poets, there's a beautiful love of tradition that's mixed contradictorily almost with innovation and experimentation. Mm. I sort of follow those things as well. I love classical forms, but my films are often accused of not being wholly narrative somehow, or, you know, that my prime focus is not the story. But I do love form and tradition, but I also love innovation. So I found that direct connection also.
That was Jim Jarmusch, the filmmaker, most recently of Patterson. Eileen, Miles, is he one of yours?
Is he one of my what?
One of your New Yorkers, New York Schoolers. Are you Jarmuschian? Is he Milesian?
No, I think Jarmuschian was kind of jokey. Of John, too. I mean, I think he was sort of having it both ways. If we're always going Ashberian and Jim is going Ashberian, too, then John would go Jarmuschian, you know? I mean, I think that it's friendly.
Oh, absolutely. I think he just wanted to hear the sound of Jarmuschian.
Exactly. Yeah, it's but it's very sweet. It's very, very, you know, like we're here together, bub. I mean, one of John's greatest poems, three poems, which is prose, which was kind of a joke, which was a wonderful thing to see, and you know, such a poet, was apparently in response to like a therapist who he'd been talking about these various relationships he had, and the therapist suggested that maybe he write a poem in which he said something to all those people, and that John had said that this poem was tons and tons and tons and tons of messages to a whole bunch of different people, and that, you know, later in his life he didn't remember who those people were, but it was an intimate gesture again. And I just think, I mean, when we talk about the New York School, what we're really talking about is a bunch of friends, you know, and even avant-garde being a code for homosexuality, that it all being kind of coterie and art being something that means you don't have to explain too much. You're in art. You know, we're already in the room, so we don't have to explain our work.
I would listen all night to stories of the sweetness of his fellowship. I mean, he was loved in a curious way. I don't know that I've ever heard people speak of poets that with the way people adored the man and his company. Adam, I mean, you knew him well. Talk about it.
Well, he just had, I mean, John was just one of the funniest people I had ever met in my life, and he was always He could always tell a really good raunchy joke, some of which I guess I can't repeat on the air. But he also could just kind of come at things from a different angle. I mean, I remember once I was asking him about, you know, it was many years ago, and I was saying, oh, well, you know, I never was able to really get into the poetry of Robert Creeley, and I've got to figure that out. And John said, why? And I said, well, you know, John, what are you talking about? Your blurb is on the back of the book. It's Robert Creeley's poetry is as essential as the air we breathe. To which John kind of just slowly chuckled and looked at me and said, well, I couldn't have exactly called it crap. You know, and the great thing about that was he wasn't at that moment letting me know that he thought Creeley was worthless, but he wasn't letting me know that that also wasn't possible. But he was kind of just commenting on the idea of, you know, why ever have one opinion about anything? And you kind of had to kind of get used to it. And you could kind of get used to the kind of weird country boy city slicker wryness that he had you about know, looking about the world. You know, for him, experience all kind of came down to a kind of great anecdote that could be deployed in an awkward moment, like being on a radio show.
Mischief in every word. I'm still getting over that line in the How to Take a Bath, where you insert your toe in the tub and hope the temperature is just right. It sounds like instructions on how to read a poem. Get into it and just sort of listen around. We're talking about the late John Ashbery. Coming up, the afterlife of a poet, or as Ashbery put it, how to continue, with Eileen Miles and Adam Fitzgerald. This is Open Source. The flood tide of Ashbery imitations and parodies has probably passed well before the poet's death last weekend at the age of 90. But young poets, just finding their voices, are still finding Ashbery inescapable and influential. Ricky Laurentiis is one of them, 28 years old, born in New Orleans, African-American, now living in New York. In an essay recently, Ricky Laurentiis asked, if a black poet opens a book of Ashbery in a forest, will anyone believe him? Where do I fit in these traditions? He spoke to me on the phone this week of Ashbery as a sometime favorite, sometimes astonishing.
It was a sort of acquired taste. It was sort of a growing into, a growing onto the text in the way that I think matches actually his poetry. He said once, I'm speaking on a very plain level, right? And then you sort of walking down the path of the poem, and then at some point you trip and you fall into this well of meaning. And that path, I should say, is different for everyone. And I think it's particularly different for someone who is black and someone who is queer and who has sort of maybe I'll say different responses or different relationships to language itself. Like the thing with John Ashbery is I always go back, and maybe this is what I kind of obsess on, is this sort of plain sense of things. This sort of, we're speaking casually as if around a dinner table, or not even a dinner table, not even as formally as that would imply, just, you know, at the McDonald's. This is how we're speaking. And inside those little pockets, we can find poetic meaning that is sort of sly and tricky, which is so often how meaning does enter our lives. You know, we don't wake up one day and say, I have changed, I am different. You know, you realize that slowly throughout maybe the morning or throughout the whole day or throughout a lifetime, if you will.
We listened to Ashbery's own reading of a favorite poem, How to Continue, to get Ricky Laurentiis's reaction.
This poem is called How to Continue. It was written after I took a trip to Ireland where I stayed with some old friends. And we went in the country there, and we went into the nearby town and went to this little shop where there was an old lady who asked us where we were from. And I said, well, I'm from New York. And she, with perfect Irish accent, said, oh, that's nice. I'm from Boston. I was rather amused by that. And so after the trip, having enjoyed seeing these friends so much, I wrote this poem, which is sort of about friendship and love. How to Continue. Well, there once was a woman, and she kept a shop, selling trinkets to tourists not far from a dock, who came to see what life could be far back on the island. And it was always a party there, always different but very nice. New friends to give you advice, or fall in love with you, which is nice. and each grew so perfectly from the other, it was a marvel of poetry and irony. And in this unsafe quarter, much was scary and dirty, but no one seemed to mind very much. The parties went on from house to house. There were friends and lovers galore all around the store. There was moonshine in winter and starshine in summer, and everybody was happy to have discovered what they discovered. And then one day the ship sailed away. There were no more dreamers, just sleepers, in heavy attitudes on the dock, moving as if they knew how, among the trinkets and the souvenirs, the random shops of modern furniture. And a gale came and said, "It is time to take all of you away, from the tops of the trees to the little houses, on little paths so startled." And when it became time to go, they none of them would leave without the other, for they said, "We are all one here, and if one of us goes, the other will not go." And the wind whispered it to the stars. The people all got up to go and looked back on love.
So I think that's an amazing poem. And look back on love is the very last line. And so there's several things going on. I mean, just very briefly, the first stanza, you know, once there was a woman and she kept the shop, selling trinkets. You kind of heard that before. It sounds like one of those like nursery rhymes. You know, once there was a man from Nantucket. So we, you know, it's sort of, it's playing with language. It's also playing with the tropes and the conventions of poetry, right? It's starting off like, well, you think this is how a poem goes. Like, so let me just sort of go in this way. But, you know, what more is there to be said? And then by the next stanza, he ends it with, "And each grew so perfectly from the other, it was a marvel of poetry and irony." And so that's the moment where I begin to say, Ricky, I'm interested in this subjectivity because it is talking back to itself. Like, this poem is a very ironic poem. You know, it's sort of saying, like, I know you probably see what's happening. I see it too. And then, you know, it goes on and continues that way. And then we get to the very last stanza. And when it was time for them to go, they would not leave without the other. But then it ends on and they look back on love, which is that whole stanza is, you know, even though the language stays, it becomes very pregnant with intention and significance. Each line becomes like, it's like almost wet with it. And it works because you could only take that because of what has come before, the sort of back and forth between the quotidian language and the, you know, very significant language. And then, I mean, just to have a sentence and look back on love, which is what I guess love can only be. I mean, when you're in love, you don't recognize it. It's a nostalgia. It's what we're doing now. We're looking back on the life. We're looking back on love. So it's, I don't know, like, it's how, and it's called How to Continue. Like, you can hear my voice. It's exciting. Like, how to continue. This is how you do it. Like, the way that, in fact, we do it. We continue each day like this, very plainly, very sort of maybe nothing necessarily special, but yet inside that sort of plainness, there are all these pockets of possibility and poetry. And that's how they continue, he says.
That was Ricky Laurentiis of the Next Generation. I mean, Miles, just one little thing, but I begin to notice there's a pattern in some of those Ashbery poems where he starts conversationally, he almost backs into the subject, you plunge into the middle, and then, bang, the punchline about love. I mean, does anybody else do that? Do you want to do that? Do we aspire? What do we learn practically as working poets?
Well, I think the fact that he was a master at doing that, that he knew he was not doing that, and then he was doing that, and then he showed you that he was doing that. You know, it's so subtle and so swift. I mean, it all kind of, I mean, there's a self-reflexiveness, which and a self-consciousness, which seems like not you know, not something that happened all at once, but something that was with him forever. It makes me think of two things. One is that the casual mention in his bio of growing up gay. I mean, he grew up gay, but he grew up gay inside there. You know, one doesn't kind of grow up gay publicly. I mean, the whole subject of how one grows up black or how one grows up gay or things that meet and things that change, because one doesn't necessarily get identified as gay. And so you're growing up gay inside here. And so you think a lot about what you do and how you do it and how you're looked at and how, you know, I mean, you can either collapse from inside or you can develop a lot of power and a lot of moves. And it's so interesting to think of this man who knew so much about himself and didn't always play it like he did. Like even the way he reads, he reports. He doesn't sell the poem. He just reports the poem, which is so cool. I mean, he's kind of a jazz musician, but his famous
poem. Oh, we got to talk about that. Did you have a poem you wanted to read, Eileen? Sorry.
Well, actually, I would a little fragment, because what I was going to say is Self-Portrait in a Convex Mirror is exactly that. It's a poem about a work of art in which the artist is looking at himself in a mirror. And it's such it's almost, you know, it's a very homosexual, it's a very adolescent vista. Hmm. And his great poem became, you know, was about that painting. You know, and so in a way, that painting, that poem made him comfortable for everyone because we knew what the poem was about. It was about the painting. But I can read a few lines of it here.
Please.
The secret is too plain. The pity of it smarts, makes hot tears spurt. That the soul is not a soul, has no secret, is small, and it fits its hollow perfectly. Its room, our moment of attention, that is the tune, but there are no words. The words are only speculation from the Latin speculum, mirror. They seek and cannot find the meaning of the music. We see only postures of the dream, riders of the motion that swings the face into view under evening skies with no false disarray as proof of authenticity, but it is life englobed. One would like to stick one's hand out of the globe, but its dimension, what carries it, will not allow it. No doubt it is this, not the reflex to hide something, which makes the hand loom large as it retreats slightly. There is no way to build it flat like a section of a wall. It must join the segment of a circle, roving back to the body, of which it seems so unlikely a part, to fence in and shore up the face on which the effort of this condition reads like a pinpoint of a smile, a spark or star one is not sure of having seen as darkness resumes.
Adam Fitzgerald, I got to ask you, how many times have you read it? How many times have you read it differently?
Quite a bunch. You know, John wasn't a big fan of that poem, or so he liked to pretend. I would love to read a poem from my favorite book. It's the first book of John's that I really kind of devoured insanely. And, you know, John always preferred the sound of the wrong word. And I always thought that was so liberating, that here is this poet who wanted to write with so much music and gorgeousness and plain speech and obscure words, and had no anxiety for his poems to sound like common sense or common logic.
Let's hear it. Times.
This one's called Your Name Here. Sure. But how can I be in this bar and also be a recluse? The colony of ants was marching toward me, stretching far into the distance where they were small as ants. Their leader held up a twig as big as a poplar. It was obviously supposed to be for me, but he couldn't say it with a poplar in his mandibles. Well, let's forget that scene and turn to one in Paris. Ants are walking down the Champs-Élysées in the snow in twos and threes, conversing, revealing a sociability one never supposed them as having. The larger ones have almost reached the allegorical statues of French cities, is it, on the Planque de la Concorde? You see, I told you there was going to bolt. Now he just sits there in the attic ordering copious plots from a nearby restaurant, as though God had meant him to be quiet. Well, you were like a portrait of Madame de Stael by Orbeck, that is to say, a little serious and washed out. Remember, you can come to me any time with what is bothering you. Just don't ask for money. Day and night, my home, my hearth are open to you, my great big adorable one, you. The bar was unexpectedly comfortable. I thought about staying. There was an alarm clock on it. Patrons were invited to guess the time. The clock was always wrong. More cheerful citizenry crowded in, singing the Marseillaise, congratulating each other for the wrong reasons, like the color of their socks, and taking swigs from a communal jug. I just love it when he gets this way, which happens in the middle of August, when summer is on its way out and autumn is still just a glint in its eye, a chronicle of hoarfrost foretold. Yes, and he was going to buy all the candy bars in the machine, but something happened. The walls caved in. Who knew the river had risen rapidly? And one by one, people were swept away, calling endearing things to each other, using pet names. Achilles, meet Angus. Then it all happened so quickly. I guess I never knew where we were going, where the pavement was taking us. Things got real quiet in the oubliette. I was still reading Jean Christophe. I'll never finish the darn thing. Now is the time.
I gotta jump in.
He's the last line. Oh, you gotta get the last line.
Okay.
Now this is the time for you to go out into the light and congratulate whoever is left in our city, people who have survived the eclipse. But I was totally taken with you. Always have been. Light a candle in my wreath. I'll be yours forever and will kiss you.
Eileen, I'm dying to toss it back to you on the jazz point. To me, John Ashbery, one way to hear him is he's Sonny Rollins.
Uh-huh.
You know, Sonny, a New York school guy with Thelonious Monk, but also a pastiche guy, emerged in the 40s, make something new. I mean, as Ashbery could be French symbolism, he could also, you know, do Popeye, but Sonny Rollins did cowboy songs as well as classics and originals and blues. A complete man of a new sensibility. He, too, has a birthday this week. 3 years younger than the great Ashbery. But there's your New York school and something new and fantastic in an American mode.
Improv. I think that's the thing that's so amazing. And we all come with different bodies of knowledge and different bodies. And then we can noodle there with our horns, with our keyboards, with our words.
With our noodles.
With our noodles, right. Adam, that poem is so amazing. And you read it in such an intimate way. The poem just kind of walks into the bar and you're with it, you know.
Beautifully read, Adam, and I stepped in at exactly the wrong moment.
That's okay. John always used to say, I mean, I think John hated the idea of poetry readings because, of course, you know, any poet will tell you poetry readings are torture. But I always felt that what was so great about John's poem is that they gave you permission to interrupt, to change your mind, to leave the poem, to fall asleep, to turn away. And aren't the best books the books that you want to stop reading and do something else and then come back to them? So I love the kind of the turn against poetry itself.
Mm-hmm. And it being mountainous, it's not. It just goes up and down. It just doesn't get higher and higher.
The marks going forward of the Ashbery School, as I said, the imitations and parodies are done. What next? What remains? How do we continue? What continues? Eileen?
I mean, I think we're in such a moment of so many styles jamming right now. I mean, I think that's one of the beauties of the 21st century is there's a no-style style. You know, there's an artless art. And I think that each person makes that mix by themselves. But I think, you know, I think the moment of something that seemed like a school was of course, even a joke at the time when it was being formed and talked about. But it definitely was an easier thing to imitate when it was new, when it was a way to say I'm one of them. And I think, you know, by the time you start saying third, fourth, fifth generation New York school, it starts to sound trite and ridiculous, and then you've got language poetry and conceptual poetry and I think people the art world, it's no longer that poets are trying to hang out with the artists and get in the studio. I think there's a lot of interest from the art world and poetry. So even outside of poetry, I think poetry's doors are kind of open and the windows are busted and there's some air getting in. And I think that's changing the art form for good. And social media, you know, bits and pieces can fly out fast.
Yeah. You know, I envy you both, your acquaintance with John Ashbery, but my acquaintance is just beginning and I look forward to it. I always also, you know, last note on Sonny Rollins, but these two men are so intensely lovable and beautiful people, which helps. Thank you, Eileen Miles, Adam Fitzgerald, Ricky Laurentiis, Steph Burt, Jim Jarmusch, and Guy Madden. There's lots more John Ashbery on our website. Dig in at radioopensource.org. Our show is produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. And finally, Walter Becker, half of the songwriting duo Steely Dan, died on the same day as John Ashbery. Walter Becker shared Ashbery's delight in obscure lyrics and our love of Duke Ellington. He was an instantly recognizable guitar stylist, here recreating Bubba Miley's trumpet on the guitar. Yeah.
I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.